All right, here we are, July 2013, ready to send Ash off to Africa with his family. So we're in the studio doing some just a little Q&A and have Ash tell the story of what's going to happen here. So I'm just going to leave it somewhat free form and let Ash expand on maybe how he got to this point. Like, and you know, Ash, you can take it back as far as you want. You can go back to school. You can go back to, you know, in Telenet days. You can go back, you know, whatever. But, you know, maybe just, you know, give us a little insight into you, into your background, just so we can get to know you a little bit. And then, you know, maybe launch in the ministry and kind of where you're at. So, and I may stop you along the way to ask questions, but why don't you just get going?
Okay. Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is that there really isn't anything in my job experience, education, or background directly that would have given me an indication that I was going to be heading toward Africa in any way at all. It's just completely something that God had planned, and I didn't really even see it coming at all. I didn't have any negative or positive feelings about working in Africa, but I did, you know, believe that I was supposed to start off in the business world, and was just pretty content over at Intellinet, working with you guys. Great bunch of folks, good company, enjoyable clients. I was really having a great time. But then a friend of mine from college, who is now my wife, but she was just a close friend at that point, was working in Mali, West Africa, with Peace Corps. And Mali is where Timbuktu is. And so what I knew was that she was about 150 miles or so south of Timbuktu, living in a little town, working with Peace Corps. And she wrote me a letter. I hadn't been in touch with her in a while, but she wrote me a letter. It took a little while to get to where I was in Atlanta from Mali, West Africa. But she said, you know, there's something over here that just, she said, I just get reminded of you for some reason over here in Koro, Mali. And there's, you know, I think you might need to come over here and just kind of hang out and see this. It's just strange, but it just makes me think of you. Would you ever consider coming to visit? And, you know, after a couple months of going back and forth with her via letters, and it was one of those kind of situations where I would write her a letter. It would take 2 weeks to get there. She would read it, you know, respond, think about it, send it back. It was another 2 weeks before I'd get a response, and that's minimum. But what happened over the course of the next 5 months was I decided that I did want to go over and visit her in West Africa and see what was going on. And part of it was that, you know, she and I just had been good friends, and, you know, I was single at that point and, was ready for a little bit of adventure too. That was, you know, the other side of it. So, just so happened that was, a year at Intellinet where, I think all of our clients were just doing well, you know, and, the quota that had been set for me, I had achieved it by the end of June. And so when I went to Jonathan Fry and I said, here's the situation, can I just take off for a couple weeks? He said, yeah, go ahead. I mean, it was one of the, you know, one of the coolest things that he could have done. And, it really changed the trajectory of where my life was going. So, when I made it over to Mali, it was completely different from anything that I'd ever seen in my entire life. The people didn't speak English. They didn't really understand the American way of life. I didn't understand them or their food, or I couldn't, you know, I couldn't take the heat. It was really uncomfortable going on public transportation when it was 110 degrees in the bus and you're packed so close to other people that you just know more about them than you ever would want to know. But in the midst of that, when I would sit down with a pastor from Mali or another person who knew Christ in Mali, even though we couldn't speak the same language or relate to each other as human beings, I felt a real just connection and a real friendship and bond with them. And that's what really surprised me, was just how easy it was for me to just sit in kind of in relational comfort with these folks when we really had nothing else in common but Jesus. And I remember going through thinking to myself, it went through my mind as I was sitting there with an elderly pastor, Pastor Gindo. And we just sat with each other for a few hours. Very little was said because we couldn't understand each other. And I just thought, it's crazy how I feel like I have more in common with Pastor Gindo than I have with my friends back in Atlanta who don't know Christ, but we have everything else in common. And that really started to change things for me. When I came back to Intellinet, really I only lasted another 6 months. And knew that it was time to move on. So I resigned from Intellinet, and about 30 days later, I was back in West Africa. I was back in Mali. Mm. And I was starting to work with young people, using music just as a platform for communication, something that we could relate to, even though we're on a language level, you know, we couldn't relate musically, we were able to connect. And I got to spend a month over there.
Well, you know, I love music. What, tell me about, you know, connecting with other people musically and what that, you know, sort of what that did and how you mm-hmm. did that. You know, you see a little bit of that in the U.S. You know, at least lived in D.C. for a little while. You go down to the mall area, and there's drum circles, and mm-hmm. you know, and that's pretty cool. It's a neat thing. What did you sense from the musical connection with these guys?
Well, African people are very musical. Music is such a huge part of expression. So when people are together, whether it's in a church or whether it's a meeting in a village or a national celebration, whether it's a soccer game, music is just a huge part of it. I remember a few years ago when fitness clubs started getting big in the urban areas of Ghana, kind of a fitness craze would happen. And you would have, 30 guys at 5 o'clock in the morning, all wearing matching shorts and shirts, running in the dark down the city streets, and they're all singing together in time. And I had a professor in college who was talking about African music and Western music, and he described Western music as like a square. That's the beat. African music is a circle. And that's, you know, very much just how it is. So there's not this kind of in a beginning and an end oftentimes. It's just a kind of a constant rhythm. And so I didn't understand all of that when I was there. I thought, well, I have the songs that I know, the songs that I play in church. So let's just do those. And they were kind of very gracious. I think that they probably thought that some of the songs when they heard them were just incredibly lame and boring and dead, you know, just kind of flat. They kind of took the songs that I taught them and just brought them into their own way of singing. And it was really cool. This was in 2001. And so they took kind of the quietish song, Open the Eyes of My Heart, and they just blew it out with dancing, you know, heavy drum beat. And they were doing it on, you know, instruments that were either homemade or just in a incredible state of disrepair. So I think I just left my guitar there when I left.
Is it safe to say, Ash, that I just listened to you talk about, you know, how you came to know these folks, you know, your introductions, your, you know, your first trip there, your return. You fell in love with African people and the African way of life. Is that fair to say, or am I oversimplifying it?
Yeah, I think it wasn't that easy. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed and felt comfortable with the people. Mm-hmm. There were things about the way of life that I saw were attractive, but also very difficult. But where this has all come from, or kind of the motivation or what got me involved, wasn't just so much that I loved Africa and I loved the people and I loved the culture. Even though I do love the people and I do appreciate the culture, it was that unexpected way that I saw that God was using me in their lives and using them in my life. Because I knew it wasn't coming from my training or my educational background. It wasn't coming from, you know, any kind of anything within myself. It was more, it was that sense of, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
And when you say unexpected, your expectations were I was going to go down and play songs and they would dig them and they would have them. And that was my little gift to them. It was, I'm going to come down and show them how to, you know, have community. Or what was that? Explain unexpected.
Well, the reason that I chose music, mm-hmm, was because music was something I knew that I could do. So I was kind of coming at it from what do I do? You know, well, let me do that with them. And that was fine as a starting point. But that, spiritually speaking, God didn't need me to do what I did best. He needed me just to go and be where he wanted me to go and be. And that way we know that, I don't pat myself on the back and say, wow, I'm doing a great job. It's look at what God has done here and look at what God is doing here. Mm-hmm. And so that's where it's unexpected, because it didn't come out of, you know, my strengths finder, you know, it didn't come out of, any kind of spiritual gifts inventory or, you know, I'm going to go to school for this. You know, I mean, I went.
Yeah, you were a software salesman of vaccination software of all things. You know,
yes, I was
dying technology. You made your quota in 6 months, selling all those suckers who are soon going to be using the internet.
Right? Well, actually, my my sales numbers went up when I stopped selling that stuff and I started selling to Frank Bell's close friends and contacts.
Network
at the beginning or middle point of the .com boom.
Oh, yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, I was trained to do other things. Mm-hmm. It seems so like God, to do something that unexpected, to take somebody like me, you know, coming from, a Mennonite background in Pennsylvania, never traveled outside of the country, never did international missions trips when I was in high school, but I think that God does that so that we don't get confused about who gets the credit.
Mm. So take it, I want to take this in whatever direction you'd like, and I'll give you a couple options. You started by introducing Carrie. And what she, how your relationship began there, and you know, sort of where it started in college, and then how it started to evolve. Or if you want to take it back, if there's another, you know, connecting point that might play into the story, And then, you know, then let's move from background into, you know, where you are now and what you're getting ready to do. So let's, but let's start there. You know, if you want to, okay. if you want to connect any more dots,
sure.
for people to get to know you a little better, your family.
Yeah. Well, my second trip, to Mali was in 2001 in the spring. And so, I did what comes so naturally to me. I saw something begin to take shape and I decided to do the rest of the shaping myself. And so, went back to Atlanta, started doing some work independently in the business world just to keep money coming in, and waited for Carrie to get back in the fall of 2001, thinking that there would probably be a good chance that we would get married and then start, you know, doing something related to West Africa. So that was my plan. That's what I was working toward. What ended up happening in actuality was Carrie's flight was to JFK on September 11th, 2001. And she ended up getting stranded first in Morocco and then finally getting home a couple weeks later through France. And she and I did get married about a year later, but... because of the trauma, not just of living in West Africa in a mud brick house for 2 years, but dealing with just the trauma of September 11th and, you know, being scheduled to fly from a Muslim country to JFK on that particular day. After we got married, if I brought up Africa or anything about going overseas, she couldn't handle it. She would end up in tears. Mm. And so all of that just got put on the background at that point. And so there was a sense where we just had to sit back. I just had to sit back and wait. And eventually I had taken my first trip to Ghana in 2002. Before Carrie and I had gotten married the same year, but previously, and got to spend a month in Ghana with a guy named Jim Moy, who had been a professor of mine in college. And, you know, Jim had invited me to work with him full time working in Ghana. But of course, you know, Carrie wasn't able to even entertain that conversation at that point. So I said no, and just continued back in business world, just doing what I could do independently, you know, and, what ended up happening was, 3 years after that first trip to Ghana, Jim, ended up passing away from a brain tumor. And that was when Carrie and I really sensed that it was the right time for us to step back in. So there was a long period between kind of that initial, wow, there's something going on here, you know, and then there was a number of years, say a number of years, 5 years, where it was just question marks. What does this all mean? You know, is this going anywhere? Is this just a one-time thing? But by that point, I had just become incredibly disinterested in software consulting. So, but I was staying, you know, I was staying in there because I didn't know what else to do.
Mm-hmm. And so, talk about, was there a breakthrough? Was there a moment or was it, what helped you turn the corner?
Well, if you remember, it was 2005, I think, mm-hmm. when I called you up and you got me in at the bank.
Do you remember that?
You know, sitting there and kind of wanting to write reports that just never seemed to come. well, that had happened, because I had left my previous job, because I wanted to work, back with, I wanted to get the ball rolling after Jim passed away. of getting back into this ministry because Carrie and I were on the same page. We felt good about it. Let's just go. But it just wasn't the right time. And so, you know, I worked with you until, you know, that project ended up just kind of falling apart a little bit. Yeah. And then you connected me in back in with Mark Harrell. And I started doing work with Mark Harrell. And it was about 5 months later. It was in the fall of 2005. No, six. This was actually 2006. That we knew that the time was right. And I took my first trip back to Ghana. So that was the turning point. But I had jumped the gun. I had made, you know, not wise decisions. I had gotten antsy and tried to force things on my own. But it didn't really matter in the end. I mean, it was God's timing ended up winning, you know, and it was great.
And let's talk about that a little bit as it relates to what you're trying to do over there. We're going to loop back on, you know, the ministry in a bit and sort of what the ministry is. But I'd love to use that as a metaphor for, you know, you're doing something over there and you're trying to, you know, you're working with the folks in Ghana for a reason but the means and the modes are important because so much has failed in Africa. So many efforts have failed in Africa for one reason or another. And so I'd love for you to explain sort of maybe more the mode than the means, and how you're doing and why you're finding that you keep getting drawn back there. God's pulling you back over there on his timing, clearly making you and your strengths not the focus. He's making his work the focus. So talk about that and give us some.
So you mean just kind of how we do things, yeah, or how,
yeah,
I've been
not
doing
what you
things.
Do or how. Yeah, let's, yeah. And we'll talk about the what in a minute, but I think mm-hmm. the how right now is because I'm going to clip this back in later. So,
okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, how we do what we do is, you know, we are focused on long-term, you know, really going deep with a few people who have been carefully selected, young people, leaders. And so it's very holistic and it's very relational. So I think about and I feel about these young men and women not like they are, you know, our product or you know, our client or our whatever, but they are, they're our friends. They're my friend. And so I'm not just concerned about one aspect of their life. I'm concerned about them as people, their families, their marriages, their economic situation, what God's doing in their life. And, you know, what can I do to, train, to mentor, to befriend, to love, to, you know, to get them, where God wants them to be, and what God wants them to be. So it's very relational. It's not just a series of classroom trainings or a set of stages that we're taking people through, but it's very personal. But it's about, that leader. You know, what we're all about is not, you know, just the gospel or just water or just sports or, you know, food or any. We are ultimately about that leader and training and mentoring and empowering that leader. But everybody's different, you know, so we end up doing different things with, you know, with different leaders. Mm. But where we've seen this go is that when we really invest deeply into a leader, into a young leader that God is really working in their life, we see that downstream of them, just what can happen. And it's so much more powerful than if I were to go and try to be them in that situation. But as we invest in them, what happens downstream from them is just incredible. I mean, it's really, that's where we've seen Africa's problems. We've seen solutions to the problems that we see in Africa. On a small scale, in a village or with a small ethnic group, not on a national level, but all of the problems that we all know just keeps Africa in a huge state of need and chaos, you know, corruption and, you know, being a huge one. Resources are there, but not properly channeled. You know, there are issues with clean water and disease that can be overcome, that the solutions to those problems are not just foundations throwing huge amounts of money. That the solutions that I have seen on a smaller scale have come from the inside. It's come from a Ghanaian person who has love for the people, whether it's people in their ethnic group or people from another ethnic group. That the solution is coming from them. So everything that we've done with clean water, doing clean water as a part of Young Leaders International was not my idea. It came from one of the leaders that I had been investing in for a few years and really gotten to know. And he came to me and was telling me about this village, and this particular village. He took me to this village. It was called Penchula. The first time that I think I was ever exposed to extreme poverty, the type of poverty where not only is everybody poor, but they don't sense any hope of ever their situation ever changing. And it was... they were having to walk. I tracked it. It was about 7 kilometers each way to get to a dirty reservoir for water. So kids didn't have time to go to school, or if they did, they weren't healthy enough. Dirty water means that there is a never-ending cycle of sickness and disease that is happening. It keeps people from improving their economic situation. And so... I mean, this was just a very, very disturbing scene in this village. And our national coordinator, Vincent Asamoah, who grew up in Ghana, you know, lived almost his entire life in Ghana. During that first visit to the village, he disappeared. And I found him later in our car weeping because he could not believe that there were people in his country who lived like this. And so the leader that I was, you know, working with, who was embedded in this village to try to help, he was a local pastor named Adam. And he said, Ash, what these people need, you know, more than anything else, you know, physically for their bodies, is they need clean water. And my response was, I don't know anything about that. I don't know how to do it. Why don't we just pray about it? And so you see there, the problem was identified not by me as an outsider. It was identified by a local leader who had genuine love for the people. He wasn't doing it for any self-serving purpose at all. He wasn't getting any recognition or notoriety from working in this village because nobody really knew or cared about this particular village. It's a mixed... kind of a mixed ethnic group, people group, you know, so nobody really paid that much attention to them. What happened was, after we had some conversations with our board of directors here in the U.S. and we really talked about this and got on the same page, then we thought, well, great, let's go dig a well. And we were excited about digging a well. And so we go back out to the village. And Adam says they don't need a well. Wells, we could bring local drilling equipment out here, but everybody's told me that We don't have the equipment to drill as deep as we'd need to go to do a well. And so again, it was, well, what do we do, Adam? And he ended up designing a system by which we would build a pavilion with a tin roof, you know, about 40 feet long and about 20 feet wide, and hang gutters on that roof. And during the rainy season, you know, when it rained, you know, it rains about 4 months, and that's your rain for the whole year, we would capture water off of gutters into huge, you know, 45 to 60,000 liter tanks with purification systems. That's not what I or any other American would have come up with, but the solution was coming from him. And it was more expensive than drilling a well, but it was us having to say, we're going to trust this leader, that he knows the problem, he understands the people, he understands their need, and what the solution is better than me, even though I'm an American. And so that's where I think that sometimes with kind of our global aid initiatives, we're bringing solutions to problems that maybe we don't fully understand. We don't understand the nuances of culture, the nuances of the need. It communicates to the people that they are helpless, that they cannot, you know, in any way, you know, that they are, you know, subservient to us in every way, including spiritually. So if we use the body of Christ analogy, we treat them like we're the head of the body of Christ and they are, you know, a finger, you know, and what we had to do as a ministry is say, we're going to turn that around. We're going to be the hand. Let them make the decisions, and we'll do everything that we can do to help them. Well, the transformation in this village after a year of clean water was absolutely incredible. You know, this village was, it would be considered to be in missional terms as unreached, that the gospel had not kind of penetrated into these people and into this people group. They were in this village, there were a few Muslims, but mostly it was traditional African religions, you know, which are, which involve a lot of hopelessness and fear, just in the theology itself. And we saw that people through this began to understand that there was a God who really loved them, that they weren't helpless to a group of local gods that were kind of finicky and sometimes mean-spirited and always had to be appeased. But they began to understand that there was a God who loved them. Otherwise, how could this have happened? As people ended up coming to know Jesus and beginning to learn and beginning to meet at the pavilion at the Water Project to learn more about God and more about what God had done for them and was doing for them, we began to see a lot of changes that trickled all throughout the village. And, you know, this hopeless village that you could barely stand to go to became a joyous place to be. We began seeing people being generous to one another instead of being suspicious to one another. So if we were neighbors and I was concerned about your crops doing better than my crops, then I would go to a witch doctor, somebody in that role, and say, let me pay you some money. You tell me what to do and let's put a curse on Chris. And whether you believe in that stuff, whether it's real or not, psychologically at least, it's incredibly debilitating because now you are my neighbor and you're either going to get the good crop or I am. So I need to do what I need to do to shut you down. Well, when that, you know, when I come to know Christ, all of a sudden is, what can I do to help Chris and be generous? So you're seeing these people who have little to nothing and, you know, nobody told them that they were too poor to be generous. And So they start going out to surrounding villages and talking about what God has done. You know, the children are healthier. You know, they're not getting sick from all these waterborne diseases. And since that time, because of what has happened in that village, it's attracted aid from other areas that we haven't been involved in. People heard about this village. And since that time, Christian Children's Fund of Canada, along with a local Presbyterian church, has built a new school. And they put another water tank there. And they built a playground. And they're, you know, going to build, I'm sure they're going to build another church that they would see as being a proper church, you know. But all of that has happened, and it hasn't really been about us. It hasn't been about Young Leaders International. You know, we were there. We cared about the people. We invested in the need. We have been investing in Adam. But it is a solution to a problem that was identified by a local leader. It was taken on by a local leader. Blood, sweat, and tears coming, you know, from this particular leader and the young people who he also mentors and disciples, if you will, in his own, you know. So it came from internally.
So we were talking about the success you had in the first village. Let's talk about what happened after that. And also don't forget to give us some timelines and maybe some dates to help tie it together.
Sure. Well, that first water project was done in 2010. That was the first one that we did. I was scared to death because we had invested about $12,000. And I was nervous because I thought if this thing doesn't work out, we're never going to be able to do anything like this again. But I wasn't in control of the process. I didn't do the design. I wasn't there project managing it. It was all about, okay, what is Adam and his team going to do? And what happened was we needed to get this thing done before the rainy season started. The rainy season usually comes in June. And so we needed to get this pavilion up and the two tanks and all the gutters hung so that when it started raining, we would start capturing the water. If we didn't get it done before the rainy season started, we weren't going to be able to get into this village with the trucks because there aren't really any roads going there. In the rainy season, it becomes, some of these villages are cut off during parts of the rainy season because of all the water. And we didn't want to wait until after the rainy season ended, or we weren't going to get any benefit from it for another year. So on one hand, it was, we need to get this done. On the other hand is, oh man, I hope this thing, you know, does not blow up on us or fall over or whatever it is. And but we just started it, and we were behind schedule, and we were working into June, but the rainy season, the rains didn't come. It was a little bit late that year, and we kept on going, and the rain still didn't come. We were in July. And they finished it in July, and still no rains. And it was very unusual. So I went over, and we had a huge kind of party. I mean, it was the music, the drumming, the dancing. You know, we had some kind of treats for the kids. We were, you know, worshiping God. We were having fun with each other. And finally, we needed to close this party down and drive back to the city. And so I asked a local pastor, Pastor Acuno, very wise, humble, intelligent, just great man. Asked him if he would close in prayer. And as an afterthought said, and why don't you pray for rain? We need rain now. And since the rainy season was about 30 to 45 days late at this point, well, Pastor Acuno got up and did one of those kind of amazing African prayers and beg God for rain, and we loaded up into the car, and as we were driving back to the city, we saw the clouds come in, and that night it rained. And it rained so hard over the next 2 weeks that both of the tanks had completely filled up, and the people were getting water from the overflow of the tanks. And I checked in a couple weeks later. I was back in the U.S. at this point. And Adam said, we're beginning to get worried because there's so much rain that it might end up destroying crops. And so we said, well, call up Pastor Okuno and tell him to pray that it stops raining. And so it was just, we just saw that, it was, everything had the potential of going wrong. I was not able to kind of manage it and control it, but, God was in control of what was going on here. Well, what happened with Penchula is that as things started changing and the people started changing, not just with their situation in life, but their worldview started changing. So when they saw that there was a God who loved them, provided for them, it freed them up just to look at their entire existence differently, including the people around them. And the hopelessness was replaced by hope. So they went to another village called Komlinili, which was in the same situation as Penchula had been. And Komlinili had heard about, this thing that was being built over in Penchula. Well, the people from Komlinili go over, and the chief, I wasn't there for this, but the chief of Komlinili, after hearing what happened in Penchula, said, I don't know who this Jesus is, but we need this Jesus. We need this change. These chiefs, they love their people. They care for their people. And it breaks their hearts that they're not able to help. The chief of the village of Penchula, I remember him telling me through a translator that the lack of clean water in his village for the children to drink was like a sore on his leg that would never heal. And the chief of Komlinili, was the same way. And so what happened was we decided to pray just that we would come up with the funds for a second water project. And as it turned out, local church down in Fayetteville that I attend, small church, 200 people, during the Christmas season, they decided to see if maybe we could get people to give to clean water, give a portion of their Christmas gift budget as families. And we were hoping that we'd be able to raise another $12,000 over the 4 weeks of Advent from 200, 250 people. And the first Sunday that we got up and talked about it, we had a high school girl carry a 3-gallon bucket of water on her head, kind of around the church as we were talking about it, just to, for fun. But that first Sunday, from this small group of people, we got $12,000. And in fact, the giving continued, and we ended up with about $30,000 just over those four Sundays from a church of, average attendance of 250 people. It was just incredible. So we did the second one, but we improved on the design and we made the tanks bigger. And we just saw so much good come from Komlinili. And so much of it was the people saying, just expressing the fact that their lives, they had felt such of a burden and so much pressure and so much stress for survival. And now they just feel free. They feel unburdened. They know that there's a God that cares about them. So that was Komlinili. We had another big party. They gave me a goat. I usually get goats as gifts and chickens and guinea fowls and stuff. And so I get my goat. We have another party. Find out later on that there was a young man, like an assistant chief from another village that had been at the celebration in Komlinili, the second village where we did. And in talking to him later, again through a translator, after that celebration, he was traveling back to his village. It would take him a couple hours to get back, and he was walking. He was just he was just feeling confused because he, you know, cared for his village. It was called Chagbuni. And a couple years earlier, he had thought, well, I'm going to speak with Muslim leaders in the city and see if they'll come and help my village. Northern Ghana, there are more Muslims than there are, you know, Christians. And it's a pretty pretty Muslim-dominated area. Well, so he had invited Muslim leaders to come to the village, and the village had, in essence, converted to Islam. They built a little lean-to mosque, and the Muslim leaders had returned back to the city and had never come back, had never really helped the people, had just said, we're building a mosque, our work here is done. And, you know, Christians are have been guilty of that so many, so many times. Let's go build a church and, you know, take off. Well, this guy was walking back to his village and was just saying, we really need this group of Christian people to come and help us the way that we've seen, you know, to get some of that change that happened over here. But he just thought, how can I invite Muslim people to my village and get everybody to convert to Islam and then bring in Christians? So he just, he didn't go to the chief, but he talked to some of his friends, and his friends went to the chief, and the chief called him and said, in essence, I'm the chief of this village. You are not the chief of this village. I decide who comes here. You do not decide who comes here. Invite these people. And Adam and his team began going to this third village, Chagbuni, along with people from Komlinyeli and Penchula. You see, so Adam's not just doing all this on his own. He's now investing his life into, you know, these leaders, you know, young men, young women, to go out and, you know, create change in other villages. And so, you know, they start going to this village, but there is, you know, a fair amount of opposition, because now this is a Muslim village. How dare you bring in Christian people? You know, the chief, you know, was all for having a source of clean water. He had the same problems that these other chiefs had in their villages, the same sicknesses, the same. You know, they weren't as destitute as Penchula. Penchula, maybe it was because it was the first time I'd ever been in a situation like that, but it's forever seared into my brain. And now I think when I see extreme poverty, maybe I'm a little desensitized to it. You know, we started building another water project. This was last year. And last summer, about a year ago, I'm back over for another celebration, but it's different. It's a celebration, but there is a conversation happening within the Muslim leaders who were there, saying, how can we allow our children to come to this Christian thing and get clean water? And it was an opportunity for me to just get up and share and say, this is not a Christian clean water project. God cares for all of you, whether you are Muslim, whether you are Christian, whether you worship traditional, you know, gods. God does not care about the Christians more than anybody else. It breaks God's heart just as much that your children are sick than the Christian children. This is for you. We're not asking anything from you except just to come and receive what is here. And after I left, because that's what I do, I come and dance and celebrate and encourage and love, and then I've been coming home. Adam continued going back to the village and just teaching the people, really just from the Bible. And it has created such an incredible dialogue between the new Christians and the Muslims, and they're just trying to work it out. And it's been just a tremendous, tremendous experience. You know, the young man who introduced us, the assistant chief, his name was Doku Giku. You know, he is, last time I talked to him, he was in the process of, you know, what do I do with my Muslim beliefs, but reconcile it with the love that I experience from these Christian people and the message that they have. So it's a really cool thing. And now, so now, through other leaders that I've known in Ghana for years, as they've seen this happen, they're working in villages and other parts of northern Ghana, and they're saying, Ash, you know, this could really be powerful. You know, can we start doing some of these up in our neck of the woods, our neck of the desert? And so one of the reasons that my family and I are going over for the next year is to look at, okay, our organization, Young Leaders International, we weren't initially organized to do projects like this. So we have to, in a sense, take a look at our organization, you know, and how can we position ourselves so we can step in, and if we want to do two of these a year, we could do two of these a year. And so that's one of the reasons that we're going over for the next year, in addition to me, you know, doing some studying at a research institute and learning more about African culture, African leadership, African mission, and so on and so forth. 6 months ago, we really sensed that it was about the right time for us to head back to Ghana. Carrie and I and our two kids at the time, 5 years ago, when Katie was three turning four and John Mark was about 18 months old, he's now six, went and spent 4 months over in Ghana. And now, 5 years later, we really sensed at the beginning of this year that it was the right time for us to go back. So we started planning a year-long trip for us as a family to, in essence, move over to Ghana. And it's been a really great experience seeing everything come together the way that it has come together. It has not been easy, and there have been a lot of just challenges and getting ready to take a family of five now. So Katie's nine and John Mark's six and Timothy's about 18 months old. And what it means for us to go over and live in Africa for a year. And it's really exciting. It's also a little nerve-wracking as well. And now we're leaving in 4 days, next Tuesday, the 30th. We're leaving at night. For an overnight to Amsterdam, and then a day-long flight the next day from Amsterdam to Ghana, and we're working through what is that going to look like on the airplane with the kids, and when we land, and you know, it's nighttime and it's heat and it's Africa and it's crazy. What is that going to be like? And just planning out, you know, what the next few weeks are going to look like as we are establishing ourselves over in Ghana for the year. But we really sense that this is the right thing, the right time, that, you know, God has put it on our hearts and in our minds to be over there. And so we're excited about it, you know, for that reason.
So what are you looking for, if anything? You know, obviously you got people back in the States that are going to miss you guys, and they're going to stay, you know, plugged in with you guys through, you know, the ways that your ministry stays plugged in with us, you know, newsletters and, you know, your social media and, you know, other things. But what are some other things that people can be thinking about that may want to, you know, connect more directly or, you know, contribute, you know, be part of this? How do you, you know, how would you advise them to do that?
Yeah, well, like I had said, we're hoping that by going over and spending some good time with our leadership team that we'll be able to reorganize ourselves in a way where we can do more than one of these water projects per year. and continue doing them in places that are not drillable for wells, that we can continue not just to throw something up and then move on to the next place, but really kind of go deep with the people and do something that is going to last and multiply the way that we saw in Penchula and Comlin Yili. So, you know, we have seen just provision money come in for the first three that we've done. But as we're looking to do, you know, maybe two or three or four in a year, we're starting to, you know, to set some money aside in a fund for water projects. So as we're doing this, as, you know, as people hear about what's happening over there and what, you know, the leaders that we're working with are doing and the success of it, as people want to be involved and feel, you know, motivated to want to have a piece of this as well, you know, then we invite people to, you know, to get involved financially, to help us do more of these and hopefully at the same time do a better job at doing them as well. We're getting better with each one that we do, but we want to improve on our process and be able to do more as well. Connect to us pretty easily through youngleadersinternational.org. Also, we are on Facebook as Young Leaders International. And then you can find a way, you know, from our website to sign up for a newsletter. We do a few mailings every year to talk about what our leaders are doing over in Ghana. And then a little bit more frequently, we'll send out emails and things on Twitter and Facebook, just really quick updates about what's happening. And with my family being over there for a year, we'll be doing a lot more of that just because I'm going to be more deeply embedded with what's going on. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are going to want to see not just what we're doing, but, you know, how my family's getting involved and interacting with all of this as well. Because this is a family thing for us. It isn't just me going out and doing it. But I'm so blessed to be married to a wife who has spent a lot of time in Africa, spent years there, and loves it, and loves even the difficult parts of it. She loves it. And, you know, my kids are excited about just having the unique opportunity to say that they lived in Africa for a year and having that experience. So it's very much a something that's happening not just with me, but with the whole family. Systems, the projects that we put in these villages are, you know, somewhere from 90,000 liters to 130,000 liters total water for a village of, you know, anywhere from 500 to 1,000 people. And so you can do a little bit of math and figure out, okay, liters to gallons and then gallons to people. And you can see that they're using this water for drinking and for cooking. But that's really all that they're using it for. And so a couple of years ago when we were doing this first water project, there we needed to have our front yard dug up and our water line replaced. And so we were without water coming into our house for about 15 hours, and I thought we were going to totally die without having clean water running, you know, into six different rooms in my house whenever I wanted it. So I went and did a Google search on how much water the average family uses in a day. And when I did a little quick math in my head, realized that the amount of water that we're putting in to support one of these villages for a year, I don't think it would even last the average American family 1 month. I think it was a couple weeks with the amount of water consumption that we use. So we treat water like it's air, like it's always there. It would be interesting to maybe with a couple of families at some point do a bit of a water fast and see what it would be like to really have to conserve water, put, you know, timers on things like showers, like you were saying, or maybe keep a big container of water out on the deck. And when you need it, you go out with a bucket and you get a little bit. Because it's just so, it's so hard for us to understand what it's like. But Rich Stearns of World Vision made a really great observation in a book that he wrote a couple of years ago that clean water really is the foundational issue for poverty. If you don't have clean water, you can try to improve education, but it's not going to work because the kids aren't going to be healthy enough to really apply themselves to the education. You can try to do economic development and microloans, but if people are having to spend so much time getting water, so much of their day, they're not going to have time to really work on their economic situation, and they're not going to be healthy enough to do so. You can put in a hospital, but people are continually going to be getting sick because they don't have clean water. So if you want to fix anything like healthcare, education, you know, any of those other types of humanitarian causes and development projects, if there's not clean water, then none of those other projects are going to be successful. This is the foundational issue of extreme poverty. And that's why I think when we've seen access to clean water in a village, you know, when we see the effects of that, then a lot of those other issues begin to get resolved as well.